Things are going to start happening to me now.
You've done all the reading. You're a scholar. You're a professor. You've done all the reading. You've done the intellectual heavy lifting.
Or less, eat shit and die.
You wouldn't know a fact if it begged you all night long.
Want to, like, give the wrong impression, because I am very high.
F***ing right up behind him with a hatchet. Smash, smash, smash.
Yeah. Care. I'm a libertarian. What I'm getting is,
did you vote for Joe Jorgensen or Trump?
Who?
Joe Jorgensen. That was the perfect answer. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. This is Tyler Yonke, Libertarian Podcast Review. We're going to angle ourselves off in a little bit of a different direction. Dead Man's Party. This is maybe the most appropriate song for this one. Plus, Halloween's coming up. How you doing, everybody? This is, look, just recently, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, they've been trending online. Jake Shields and other ones started this ban the ADL, and it partly because the ADL is coming out wanting to censor people on Twitter. So there's been a reaction to it. And that reaction, rightly so, seems to be. Anyway, so part of this is the ADL. How did they get developed? How did they come about? And with that, there's this famous case about Leo Frank, Mary Fagan, and a bunch of other people in 1913. So what we're going to do is we're going to walk through this case. It's going to be several episodes, I believe, of it. And we're going to talk a little bit about the overview, the issues at the time. We're going to break down the details, the whodunit stuff with the case, why Leo Frank is guilty. And here's the deal. Leo Frank, a young 29-year-old Jewish man from Brooklyn, moves down south, marries this lady, Mary Siegel, Selig, and they're a prominent Jewish family in Atlanta in 1913. Then this girl dies. We'll break all this down. And from this whole upheaval comes the Anti-Defamation League that we know of today, and also a resurgence of the KKK. So there's some fascinating things along the way. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to, in this one, we're just going to do some peripheral things. We're going to break a few things down, and then in the next one, we're going to go into piece by piece. Now, what came about from this is an in-depth trial. Well, a 30-day trial. At the point, it was the longest one, I think, that they had had in Georgia, at least. Famous solicitor, the prosecutor, two famous defense attorneys, and then there's an appeal from that. Multiple appeals, goes up to the Supreme Court, and they finally deny it. There's a commutation. We'll talk about that. There's a death. There's a lynching. All the good things you would expect from a good 1913 to 1915 case in the South. So we'll get to it. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to do an overview and summary of the case. Talk about a few things there. Pop culture with that, propaganda, whatnot. We're going to do an overview of Georgia in 2013 here, but that is not the case. It's 1913. I'm changing it right now on my sheet. 1913. Overview in Georgia in 1913. We're going to talk about what, I mean, some of it has to do with, look, our buddy John Ziegler talks about Penn State and the whole thing with Sandusky and how that is a perfect storm, okay? And this perfect storm comes about and it just proliferates what we have here. Kind of the same thing. You have to understand the tensions, everything in the South at the time in the 1913. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the main characters. We'll talk about side characters. We'll talk about the murder trial itself and the timeline. We'll talk about, this is where I'm really going to get into it, is the appeals and the timelines from that and what took effect and what are the important factors that come out of these appeals that we have. And then there's a commutation, then there's the outcome, the overall, which is ADL, KKK, and which one is really winning at this point, and why is it that and then, by the way, there's a not an exoneration, but a pardon, and so we'll talk about all of that coming up. Okay, so let's maybe break down, first and foremost, what we have here I guess I should give you the players before I should give you much of anything else. So with that in mind, we're talking about Leo Frank. Like I said, he's 29-year-old from Atlanta. man, my arm is killing me. Okay, so before we go to everyone in here, well, the gist of it is Leo Frank runs this pencil factory, the NPC. He's an NPC, non-player. National Pencil Corporation, and he runs that in Atlanta. He's a Jew from Brooklyn. This is all important. Now he's working on a Saturday. It's actually closed. It's actually a holiday. It's the Memorial Day, Confederate Memorial Day, and in Atlanta, and a girl comes in. Now, workers, this is the time kids, young kids were working in factories. This is a 13-year-old girl, Mary Fagan. She's working in this factory. She hadn't worked. She worked one day this last week because the metal that comes in, she worked on a knurling, that's for you, Cole, machine, and the metal came in, hadn't come in for the pencils, so she hadn't been able to work, but she was owed $1.25. So she was owed $1.25, so she comes in to get her paycheck. This timeline gets established later on, but it's at noon on a Saturday. Why is this young Jewish man working on a Saturday? I thought he was a good Jew. Maybe not, but he's working. She's an Irish Catholic girl, okay? And she comes in to get her money, and no one sees her again until the next morning. Someone finds her at the factory. So she never leaves the factory. So you have everything contained as to this factory's closed on the day. She rode on the train with her friend George Epps and got there, and then some people see her, Mr. Leo Frank does, and then the whole situation comes about because there's a night watchman who's black, there's a sweeper, another guy that works there, he's also black, and they are the ones that kind of get pinned with this, but Leo Frank eventually gets tried, convicted, appealed, and we're going on from there. So that is the state. And why is it in 1913? I think, so we need to break down the actual issues with 1913 in the South, right? And before I do that, this thing just goes ballistic. And we'll talk about that actually when we get to it here. So let me play some clips here. This is from a book, and it's called, and they did a documentary too, called The People versus Leo Frank. Now, the overall thing of this one, there is some good stuff with it. There are also some bad stuff as far as some people that, to me, are a little bit too pro-Frank. Let's see, adjust that there. But here we go. This is, I think this first one we have talks about, what's this one? Atlanta in 1913. Take it away.
In April 1913, Atlanta was giddy with excitement. The New York Metropolitan Opera had just come to town, a clear symbol of how far Atlanta had risen from the ashes of the Civil War. A small town of 7,000 had become a booming city of nearly 180,000, the industrial gateway to what we call the New South.
What really made it grow was that it became a magnet for a lot of businessmen who see this city that's now at the center of this developing South as the place to make it.
Okay, there you go. So that's Atlanta starting out there. We're going to just keep playing some more of these. This one goes along with kind of the Jews in the South at that time. So I don't know that you necessarily think of the Jewish population in the South part of the United States, Atlanta, Georgia, but here you are.
The German Jews came early on to Atlanta, and they opened dry goods shops. They sold perfumes. They sold window glass. They were accepted. The small shop owners became large shop owners, and the first Jewish merchants, the German Jewish merchants, the Seligs, the Montags, the Riches, became prominent Atlanta citizens. They were part of the upper crust.
When I was in school, we sang Dixie, and when we did, we stood up. I was proud to be Jewish, and I was proud to be a Southerner. Now, to most Jews, especially those raised in the North, that seems like an oxymoron. But it wasn't. Not to me.
As the lady told me, oh, that Dr. Marks, what a fine Christian gentleman he is. They weren't talking that he wasn't Jewish because they knew he was Jewish. They knew the temple was Jewish, but he lived a good life according to the same type of things that they believed in.
Wearing a yarmulke, a skull cap, too Jewish. Get rid of that. Bar mitzvahs, too Jewish. Hebrew, using Hebrew in the service, too Jewish. He was Dr. Marks. He was never Rabbi Marks.
But by the turn of the century, Atlanta's Jews feared a new wave of immigrants from Eastern Europe were giving their Christian neighbors a bad impression.
The women wore kerchiefs. They kept kosher. They were doing strange things on holidays, like swinging chickens around by their feet. The German Jews found this to be, this is from the ghetto already. You know, what you're bringing this to Atlanta? Why, you know, this is what you should have left behind in Poland, in Ukraine, in Russia. Why are you bringing that here, where we're so much like the Episcopalians? By the time Leo Frank arrived, the position of the German Jews had become a little more precarious.
Okay, so that's kind of the idea of the, and I'm trying to make it sound ominous. I don't know that it's necessarily that bad. I just want you to see what some historians are saying about this. How about blacks in the South? We know kind of the Civil War, some things that took Reconstruction, you know, slave trade and all that. So let's talk about that.
There is a tradition of Lynch law in which the people felt perfectly free to act on their own.
Take them out and kill them, be it by hanging, burning, a combination of the two, shooting, and all those occurred. Sexual mutilation, gouging out of eyes, cutting off of ears.
The constant cry was, black men are lynched because they're raping our wives and daughters. In fact, the great majority had nothing to do with even accusations of rape.
There are hundreds of stories on which men have been lynched or nearly lynched because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Okay, so by the way, this is important because you got to get the semblance and understanding because it's going to play a big part as to the biases and whatnot of everybody, and especially, look, sexual, this, okay, we'll get to that. But Mary Fagan, there's a lot of contention out there, there's conjecture that she was raped and killed. She was definitely killed. Was she raped? That's of questionable. We'll go through the coroner and the autopsy here, the coroner's inquest and the autopsy. It looks like possibly sexual, maybe something was going on, but I don't think she was actually raped. But there's a lot of thought at the time that she was, and the coroner had to testify as to that. So with that in mind, especially you just saw it here that they're thinking that every black man is basically sexually molesting their children and their wives. That's a big thing to think of and just keep in context as to what everyone actually believed at the time when the facts come out. Okay, this one is, I think it's the last one we'll do here. This is newspapers and the battles and with this guy, Tom Watson, who is one of the key figures in this whole case. But I thought it was important to kind of understand the news, how that's portrayed. Now, we can go back into how the news basically way back to Jefferson and Adams, because you know there's big cases that have come along with this and then just made the news exciting, and there's you know scandal mongers and such that rake muckers or muck rakers as far as news goes back, you know, since the Revolutionary War. So that's nothing new, but it did help spur this, especially you have this divide of the North and the South and how that plays a part of it. Anyway, so let's kind of take a look at this news battles.
Meanwhile, the New York Times intensified its coverage of the Frank case.
This was the first crusade that Adolf Oxen ever embraced. The Times pulled out all the stops. They hired investigators to go back to re-examine all the evidence. They had reenactments.
Adolf Ox commissioned a report that concluded that after Mary got her pay, Conley jumped and robbed her. Then he pushed her down the ladder to the basement,
where he...
Okay, I just got to stop this there. If you're watching it on video, they're showing these recreations that this guy did, and they took pictures. I think it's the owner in the New York Times. There's... This is the at the time. So this is the, there's you have to understand, especially with the North really took this mantle on, and the ADL has done so. And anyone that's trying to say Leo Frank is innocent, their big call to this is that he was a prejudice because he was a Jew. Now they will go out of their way to rip the black man. And matter of fact, that's what I'm pointing out here. So you have this New York Times publisher doing reenactments, and just instead of using an actual black man or just another man, you know, you can just say it. They painted this guy up in black. It's so obvious. They use a white guy here with like shoe polish on him and his face. And you can see the white on his hands to show how he is a reenactment for this killing. So they have to use a white guy to show you can't actually use just a black man. Or just don't use one. And I know everyone's like, oh, you know, it's maybe Tyler, you're all woke. Like you have to use the actual person. I'm just saying they went through the effort of making this guy actually all blackface. So that, they wanted to emphasize he's a black man. And we'll get into some of the if you just control F if you or command F for some of the testimony and write the N-word in there in full. It comes up a lot.
Assaulted and killed her. Though Ox chose not to publish the report or its photos, he was convinced they represented the truth.
What Adolf Ox naively did not understand was that the resentment of the New York Times would be perceived as gross invasion on the part of outsiders, and especially Yankee Jewish outsiders.
The resentment was voiced by Tom Watson, a populist who had twice run for president. Now a celebrated defense attorney and publisher, Watson used his paper, The Jeffersonian, to rebut the New York Times.
Tom Watson was my great-grandfather. When Watson initially talks about the case, it is very clearly in Watson's mind a populist struggle. It is abuse of a working class girl by a manager who is supported by money.
I think Tom Watson reacted in the way that many white Southerners did. You may welcome guests into your house, you may welcome guests into your community in a very warm, hospitable way. That Southern hospitality is very real. But the moment they begin questioning you, challenging you, it's a challenge to your honor.
He is reading the various press reports and is angered. Watson is also pointing out the fact that many of the newspapers are owned by Jews. Watson starts fleshing out the case, showing his readers the facts of the case and presenting the evidence to them.
Anybody who thinks that Watson's newspaper simply laid out the evidence needs to go and read it. It's filled with a kind of invective and over anti-Semitism.
Watson did not shy from referring to Frank as a Jew pervert, lascivious Jew. More often than not, Watson referred to him as the filthy sodomite.
All right, well, was he? I mean, let's see. Let's add this. So there's Leo Frank. There's a picture of him. He looks suspiciously like some other based people that we know. And there he is being hung in 1915. Well, it's kind of cut into the chase there of what actually happened. Okay, so with this in mind, I thought we would. That's kind of giving you some overview, a little bit of some of this, but I also went a little bit further. I just thought we would talk about some of these other things here, and I'll just read a few things off. So, writer, this is writer Aaron Scott Aaron gives insight into Southern attitudes towards Jews when he says, in the race-conscious South of 1913, Jews were considered white. In fact, in the newspapers of Atlanta before, during, and after the trial of Leo Frank for the murder of Mary Fagan, Frank was referred to as a, quote, white man, unquote, in innumerable occasions by reporters, witnesses, African-Americans, fellow Jews, pro-Frank partisans, and anti-Frank polemicists. Jews, furthermore, were not known for violent acts or crimes, nor feared as violators of white women. If anything, they were seen as an unusually industrious, intelligent, and law-abiding segment of society, even if they were a bit peculiar in their religious views. Hey, hey. There we go. Hang on. Marriage between Jews and Christians might have raised a few eyebrows in both communities, just as did intermarriage between members of widely different Christian denominations, but it was far from unknown, as such couples were not ostracized. In fact, Leo Frank's own brother-in-law, Mr. Erschenbach, with whom he canceled an appointment to see a baseball game on the day Mary Fagan was killed, that's a key part of this scene, by the way, was a Christian. Quote, if there was prejudice against Leo Frank in 1913 Atlanta, it was almost certainly not because he was a Jew. He was, however, a capitalist, a business owner, a manager, an employer of child labor, and a Northerner with an Ivy League degree, league education. Yeah, I think he went to Brown. He got a mechanical or an engineering degree. He also came to be known during the course of the trial as sexually profligate. These facts probably did count against him. Right. So we talked about some of these other ones, and I just thought I'd bring up a few things that kind of reminded me of some of this, which is there's a few famous cases. We'll kind of all take part of this one. And what the part to me that's real interesting is kind of the legal aspect of this. Some of the legal aspect being and we'll get into it, which is the rules of evidence and how they are done. Appeals, trials, everything like that. There's a few odd things that took place in some of these court and in the court. We'll talk about that. And then in the appeals and the Supreme Court, and I had to read a lot of this stuff. Now, what's interesting is, and I'll just, Whitaker Chambers and Alger Hiss. I don't know if you know that situation, but that was post, when was that? Around 1940 or so. It was during the World War II, right into the end of that. It was during and right after. Matter of fact, it extended into the 60s, but it was in the 40s is when this really came about. There was HUAC and some of these other House on Un-American Activities Committee. Whitaker Chambers was a communist, and he was doing secrets for the Soviet Union. He was kind of a vagabond. Then he decided to get out of it, and he got out of it. He became a Quaker. He was an amazing writer, and with his writing skills, he ended up being the head, one of the head writers for Time magazine, and then wrote a book called Witness. But before that, he basically said there are communists within us. He became friends with William F. Buckley, blah, blah, blah. And at one point, he accused this guy, Alger Hiss, of being in the State Department. He was actually at Yalta with FDR, of being a communist spy. Alger Hiss was the cream of the crop. He and his wife, and now Whitaker Chambers had bad teeth. He was deplorable. He was fat, but he was an amazing writer, and he was a little bit dour. So Alger Hiss says, we were friends with he and his wife at the time. He gave me secrets that he had acquired from the State Department, and I passed them on. And I still have some of those. And it was Nixon came out to his property, and they were microfiche in a pumpkin. They're called the pumpkin papers, and he passed them on. So anyway, it was a big deal. Then Alger Hiss was just outraged, and he was a little bit, it's kind of like Leo Frank, where he decides that he is too, he's the cream of the crop. How dare you do this to me? And he does kind of the thing that Lance Armstrong does that ruins him, which is he decides to file a defamation case against Whitaker Chambers for defaming him. He testified against HUAC. So now there's this defamation case, and he actually loses. I mean, quite big time. And he's devastated. It's a right and left thing. But this black book of communism, there's a few other books that come out and secrets where from the Soviet Union, when the wall fell, the Alger Hiss definitely was a spy. And with him definitely being a spy, it kind of vindicated the whole Whitaker Chambers thing. But once again, this is a big thing that took the nation to whatever. And it's this class struggle, in a sense, of the you demean the person so below you. He's so below me. He has bad teeth. I would never associate with him. But you were doing this for ideological reasons. Kind of reminded me of that in this sense, where Leo Frank just thinks all the time, I'm this perfect. I'm this Jew. I'm upstanding citizen. These are the black men below me. They're pieces of crap, or the women that are working here, all pieces of crap. I'm never worried about this. And they convict him. Then, matter of fact, they sentence him to death. O.J. Simpson, that's another one. The kind of the thing there is the be able to have the money. The Jewish lobby really dumped money into this. And when you read through, it's fascinating to me when you read through all the Supreme Court cases and the filings. I mean, you know, they're just hundreds and hundreds of pages. Day after a conviction, boom, the next day he's sentenced to death. That day he's also filing for a new trial. And these are extensive filings. Now, it's not as easy as where we just have, you know, scan stuff in. I mean, they had to type all this stuff out. So he had, you know, a bunch of people working on these things. So he obviously had money. He had the best defense attorneys at the time. Reminds you of the O.J. Simpson with the money situation, being able to dump millions of dollars into his, you know, dream team. But always remember, anytime that's happening, the other side is sponsored by the state, and they can always outspend you. So that's always the thing there. Alex Murdaugh, the murder trial that took place down in Georgia. That was another Georgia murder. And what's interesting there is, you know, you can have facts against the case and you want to have due process and everything. I just found that one interesting for the fact that I felt that they railroaded him on that one. Rittenhouse, Johnny Depp, these are also things. So some other things that we have to do with 1913 in the South, economics, they're starting to be on the upswing. There's still segregation, Confederate Day. It's not that long removed from the Civil War. Matter of fact, one of the movies, and we'll talk about popular culture here. It's The Murder of Mary Fagan. It was like NBC series, two-part miniseries. And the actors, and this is 1988, and the actors that were in there, phenomenal. I mean, it's kind of crazy. But one of the things they have in that movie is they talk about Stonewall Jackson's wife being there for Confederate Day, Memorial Day. Fascinating. Yeah, I mean, that's how, you know, the Civil War. I mean, there's, you know, think about it. Woodrow Wilson was just elected and he took office, I believe. This happened in April and he took office in March of 1913. So Woodrow Wilson, horrible president, brings in the progressive era, helps bring that in. That's already kind of established and going forward, and he just full throttles it here. But, you know, he was born 1913. It's 13 years, another 20 some years to the Civil War. I mean, you know, you're definitely born before the Civil War. You saw this war happen. And by the way, side note here, I always think it's fascinating when you read books. I've read some of these books about like the Civil War, and then you read books about World War One and the machinery that changes, the technology change over there. I mean, you know, the Model A was 1908 of Henry Ford. Then he starts having starts things into production for the assembly line for World War One, and it made a huge difference. You know, we were able to kill people at a much better rate in World War One than we were just from the Civil War. And there's people that were connecting to both of those. So imagine going to being in the Civil War and then seeing the destruction that can happen in the World War One. I mean, you're using cavalry, you're using not muskets necessarily, repeater rifles. And then the next thing you have, you know, just gas warfare airplanes. Kind of fascinating. Okay. So once again, not so distant past there, Stonewall Jackson's wife, Reconstruction had just happened. And you talked a little bit about that where he talks about, and you know, we need to probably play a clip from, let me get that here. Okay, so this is going to be Dr. E. Michael Jones, episode 942 of the Pete Quinones Show. Let's see if we can have this. And
there was virtually no consciousness of Jewish existence in the South at that point. The only Jew the South ever knew in 1913 we're talking about now was Judah Benjamin, who was the treasurer of the Confederacy. That was it. After the Civil War, when the so-called carpetbaggers showed up, the carpetbaggers were largely Jewish furnishing merchants who had arrived like a plague of locusts to basically take over the economy and create a usurious economy where the sharecroppers had to borrow money from the Jewish furnishing merchants in order to get the crop going. And then at the end, when the harvest came, they ended up owing more money than they had at the beginning in the spring when they planted the crop. So even that did not really turn the Jewish issue or ignite the Jewish question in the South, even that. And what did it was the Leo Frank and his pencil factory. What you had here is the heart of the redemption, okay, which is basically when the South broke the resistance of the North. The occupying army went back north, and that's when they started erecting all these statues to General Lee that caused problems in places like Charlottesville. Okay, so they had won at that point, and the country was, the South was pretty much under the control of, if not the Ku Klux Klan, then certainly people who sympathized with white supremacy, to use that overused term now. And as a result, when Leo Frank was arrested, the lawyers thought, well, we'll pin this whole thing on a black man. Well, let's face it, the jury in a place like this would be naturally predisposed to find a black man guilty because they were all prejudiced against black people at that time. The Jewish lawyers, the Jews from New York City who started a huge publicity campaign, didn't understand what they were doing. They didn't know the people they were dealing with. And so they thought that this campaign was going to be successful. All we got to do is throw money around. We got the big. And Leo Frank was sitting in jail just perfectly confident that he was going to get off because he knew he had Jewish privilege. Even if the South didn't know that, he knew it. And he knew that he had supporters in the North, influential people in the North, even at that time. We're talking about 1913 when newspapers were really powerful. Newspapers were powerful. They were the...
Okay, so I just thought we'd, first of all, take that there. So a nice little breakdown of another thing about... I just want to set the scene as much as possible so we understand. Because what I've really got back from this, and I went through a whole audiobook that was written, and I want to say it was either 1913, right after the trial, and I believe that's what it was, not even 1915, but 1913 after the trial. And there was some significant things. It was definitely a pro Frank book, but what's the best thing to have there is what's not included. And what's not included are a lot of the things we're going to talk about, which is the mob mentality that he's railroaded, this whole thing about him being a Jew. That was really devised by the defense to try to manipulate the jury at the time. And it just didn't work. Okay, so we've gone through that. Reconstruction happens, and by the way, that's what I wanted to talk about with E. Michael Jones there, talking about the moving out and taking over the South again, because there's Reconstruction from, 1863 to, 1890. That's kind of the frame you had there. And with that, there's mixed views as to what Reconstruction – I'm not a historian, but go back and review that. There's mixed views as to what Reconstruction really meant for the South. And if you look at it, I mean, you're bringing in – you just got defeated in this battle. You've lost – hundreds of thousands of your own people. And sometimes it's, brothers in the North fighting brothers in the South. That's a band of we've heard about that. I think that was Ken Burns did that, and it was one of the North and South or one of those movies. But anyway, that you had those situations, and then what you now have is the North comes down and they militarize the South to make sure that you're following, enforcement acts, anti-slavery stuff, all kinds of the Mann Act, all these things are going into effect to really put the pressure on the South. And there's the Dunning School that said, Reconstruction is just a horrible mess. There's other historians that say the opposite. Now, with that in mind, remember, Wilson is then elected president April 4, 1913. He brings in the whole thing of the Progressive Era, But there's this, we're going to talk about this guy, Tom Watson. But I just thought this was interesting because he's considered, we just mentioned it, his grandson, I think, was talking in that video there. But here's one thing. In his essay, The Negro Question in the South, quote, that's the name of the book, or the essay, The Negro Question in the South. Watson framed his appeal for a united front between black and white farmers, declaring, "You are kept apart, that you may be separately fleeced of your earnings. You are made to hate each other because upon that hatred is rested the keystone of the ark of financial despotism, which enslaves you both. You are deceived and blinded that you may not see this race antagonism perpetuates a monetary system which beggars both." It's a little bit flowery, but he's a populist at the time. Watson was a congressman. He was not reelected as the populist party disintegrated through his periodical, The Jeffersonian, that's his publication there. Watson crusaded as an anti-Catholic, that's important, and eventually a white supremacist, that's what they say. He attacked the socialism, good for him, which had attracted many former populists. His campaign, with the little success of the party's candidate for presidency in 1904 and 1908, Watson continued to exert influence on Georgia politics and provided a key endorsement of the gubernatorial campaign of M. Hoke Smith. Okay, later on. By the way, he was pretty tight with George Slayton, who was the governor at the time during all this happened, who then takes upon himself whether he's going to commute the sentence or pardon the sentence or the conviction of Leo Frank in general. So what's interesting there, and we'll talk about this, Tom Watson, one, they say he's a white supremacist, but he's also reaching out to blacks as far as some unity on some things. Then he's very anti-Catholic. Now, what did I say about this whole thing initially? So you have blacks, they're going to be a prominent part of this story. You have Catholics, which was Mary Fagan. She was killed, and he was very anti-Catholic, but now you have a Jew in the mix. So what is going to be this hodgepodge of deals, of this whole scenario here of all this? Another thing in the South, at the start, we would say this real quick, cotton prices increased in 1911 as the boll weevil hit the West really hard. It caused cotton's just being grown out in Georgia. The boll weevil didn't hit there until 1915. So the progressive era then was in full swing. Think of like cocaine on a high before you finally die, which is the Great Depression. There was also semi-prohibition drinking with some loopholes about whiskey importation, which comes into it. I found this fascinating kind of reviewing this because of, like, you know, what was going on in Georgia at the time. Because there's drinking involved and they're supposedly under some sort of prohibition, but nothing ever gets talked about in the official things, like, you're drinking. But anyway, that's what it is. What about this whole case in popular culture? During the trial, the Atlanta musician and mill worker Fiddlin' John Carson wrote and performed the murder ballad titled Little Mary Fagan. During the mill strikes in 1914, Carson sang Little Mary Fagan to the crowds in the Fulton County courthouse steps. His daughter, Moonshine Kate, later recorded the song, an unrecorded Carson song, Dear Old Oak in Georgia, sentimentalizes the tree from which Leo Frank was hanged. Leo Frank case has been the subject of several media adaptions. 1921, African-American director Arthur Michaud directed a silent race film entitled The Gunsalus Mystery, followed by Murder in Harlem in 1935. In 1937, Mevrin Leroy directed They Won't Forget, based on the Ward Green novel Depth in the Deep South, which was in turn inspired by the Frank case. An episode in the 1964 TV series Profiles in Courage dramatized Governor John M. Slayton's decision to commute Frank sentence. The episode starred Walter Matthau as Governor Slayton, and Michael Constantine as Tom Watson. In the 1988 TV miniseries, The Murder of Mary Fagan was broadcast on NBC starring Jack Lemmon. Remember, Walter Matthau, Jack Lemmon, then come together and do Grumpy Old Men or Dirty Old Men or something like that. It's two movies that they did there with those guys. Funny stuff, but they did those. He was also featured as Jack Slayton and also featured Kevin Spacey. Interesting that Kevin Spacey is in a movie about a pedophile. The 1988 Broadway musical Parade, based on the case, won 2 Tony Awards. 2009, Ben Loderman directed the documentary film The People versus Leo Frank. I know, we just played clips of that. 2023 Broadway revival Parade won the American, or the Tony Awards for Best Revival of a Musical and Best Direction of a Musical. I just put a note here. As you would expect, Hollywood doesn't do a good job in portraying the truth about this event with these movies. The miniseries, the Murder of Mary Fagan, look who here's in this one. Starring Jack Lemmon, Richard Jordan, Kevin Spacey, William H. Macy. It goes on and on. They're not even putting everybody that was in here. Let's see if I could have Charles Dutton, William Newman, Peter Gallagher. It's crazy. All the people that were in this movie. I think even William H. Macy, who's, you know, William H. Macy. I think it's he doesn't really get to speak, but they cast him now as like a cast member. He's prominent visually, but I don't even know if he ever gets to say anything. It was not a good movie. It was much too favorable to Leo Frank. You're watching it to begin with, and there's certain things that happen. Like it shows Leo walking into the girls where they're changing. He's like, "Oh, I'm sorry." Now all the testimony is like, this guy was a creep. He would walk into the girls' bathroom or where they're changing in there, and he would just stand there and talk to them, and they felt very uncomfortable. And this was always like, and by the way, it's Peter Gallagher, who I played golf with once. Anyway, okay. We'll just move on from that. So there you have it. That's kind of the breakdown of where we're at with the South. Now we'll talk about some of these other ones. We'll talk about the main characters here. You have Leo Frank. Once again, we've talked about him several times. This Jewish guy, 29 years old, factory worker. Mary Fagan, she's 13-year-old. I mean, he's a factory foreman slash supervisor, whatever. His uncle, I think, owns the factory. 13-year-old factory worker is Mary Fagan. She's, some called her a little bit large. Other ones was like she's what's the word I'm thinking here? She's unexpectedly or something like that attractive. Okay, so, I don't know what that's kind of a weird way to say that 13-year-old was hot. Okay, I think that's what it is. Newt Lee, he was a night watchman at NPC. He had been working there since, I think, 1908, but he was new as far as the night watchman goes. That's the first person that Leo Frank tries to pin the murder on. Jim Conley, he's a black worker at NPC. He, by the way, there's only two people, we're going to come right away with this. There's only two people that could have murdered this girl, Leo Frank or Jim Conley. They're both gross. There's no doubt about it. Conley comes away with this, and he does a great job of testifying, does his own thing, but he is not a so good person. Matter of fact, Newt Lee would say about him that Jim Conley is a low level, and then do I need the bleep? N-word. I'm going to have to say the N-word in here because they use it constantly throughout this trial. Hugh Dorsey is the solicitor. He's a prosecutor. He had been a civil attorney, but then he became elected for in Georgia there for like the attorney general type of thing in Atlanta. And he becomes somewhat popular from this. And you read the anti-Frank or the pro-Frank stuff that he wasn't guilty. And it's really interesting. They try to say, oh, this guy just was out for publicity. Okay, but he still got a conviction. I mean, you know, you got to do what you got to do. Tom Watson, we mentioned him a few times. He's a populist party kind of guy, attorney, congressman, publisher of this paper called the Jeffersonian. Luther Rosser, he was the main defense attorney for Lee. And then John Slayton, he's the Georgia governor. These are kind of the main people we're going to be talking about here. What's interesting, too, is the Georgia governor, John Slayton, ends up, and then you got this, remember, Luther Rosser is an attorney, the defense attorney for Leo Frank. John Slayton becomes the governor, and he's going out in 2015, and he ends up, takes on, where I'm going to commute the sentence or so of this Leo Frank. Maybe I'm going to do that, or pardon him. We're going to figure this out. While he's doing this, he has a job lined up to work for the law firm of Luther Rosser, who just tried to defend Leo Frank and through all these appeals. Now there's like a slush fund that's, you know, from the Jewish aid, which comes out to the ADL after this, that is just humongous for Leo Frank, which again, I told you that there's just all kinds of filings, appeals being done. And with that, there's a ton of money. So Luther Rosser is just banking it. Matter of fact, they said his law firm was so prolific before and after all this thing too. They were one of the first law firms to do like over six figures a year. Now, once again, this is, Mary Fagan goes in there and she's getting paid $1.25 that week. She missed a day. Conley, the black guy that worked there, he was actually one of the highest paid kind of those people that worked there, making $6.05 a week. So I think Newt Lee was around $4.25. So when they're making that a week and this law firm is making, you know, $200,000 a year, they're obviously doing well. John Slayton, the governor, has a job to go work as one of the main attorneys there, the firm that Luther Rosser is, and he makes a decision on the commutation, and we'll talk about that. And by the way, you look at that movie, they make him like he's just the most noble man ever, but yeah, please. Some side characters, Mrs. Frank, we're going to talk about her a little bit. Judge Roan, he's the judge of the trial judge. He does take a few appeals here, and then we have witnesses. There's girls that testify. There's this guy, Alonzo Mann. He's a 14, there's a lot of 14-year-old kids going around here. I think he was around that age. He might have been a little older. George Epps is one of these kids we're going to talk about too. He's 14. He testifies. I'm trying to remember this guy's Lauren, Gant. He's a person kind of in that whole thing. And we will go through his testimony as well. And then there's the coroners, there's the detectives. Then there's these two investigation firms that kind of go about and some bad info about evidence being planted. Okay, let me go over this murder timeline. So what do we say? April 26, 2013, she's killed. You then have a coroner's inquiry. They come about, there's 26 people on the coroner's inquiry. They are, maybe that's on the grand jury, but they decide to put, or the coroner does, it decides to push it on to the grand jury. The grand jury takes it on to, and there's 26 there. There's like five or six Jews on that. It's just an important thing to just know. I'm just going to say it, not as a derogatory comment, but just as a statement. The grand jury then indicts him on May 24th, 2013. The grand jury, He gets a guilty verdict. He goes to trial. It's a 30-day trial. 8/25, 2013, a guilty verdict. 8/26, 2013, he is sentenced to death. And then we've got this timeline for appeals, okay? 10/31, 2013, just a few months after the trial, they file a motion in the Superior Court for Judge Roan. That's the way they have to do it. The same judge just heard it. Now gets to decide, and they file for a motion for a new trial. This is very important, and we'll get to it later when we break down the case as to why and what those reasons are for a new trial. I'll also tell you about when you go to trial and then you ask for an appeal, you don't get to say, hey, this jury, they made the wrong decision. No, you have to ask on basically errors or reasons why this would be after evidence, after the fact type of stuff, and or that your due process rights, that's what we're going to talk about here, due process rights were not, they were stamped upon, okay, or whatnot. So on 8/26, 2013, they file that, and then they do an amended motion, adding a few things to it on October 31st. The same day, Judge Roan comes back and says, motion denied. They push it on up to this Supreme Court of Georgia, motion for a new trial, this time taken on a writ of errors, and they deny it as well on February 17, 2014. A motion then is to set aside the verdict in the Superior Court of Fulton County. It's denied, moved to the Supreme Court of Georgia. It's also denied on 11/14/2014. 11/18, 2014, application of writ of errors made to the Supreme Court of Georgia, again, denied. Well, that was the one, the application they denied. Then there's an application on 11/21/2014 for a writ of errors made to, and by the way, this just means we're asking for an order that there's errors made in this judgment, and therefore to reverse or to remand it down to have a new trial. And we'll talk about those when we break down each one of those kind of things in there. It was also denied. Then 11/21/2014, this is where they start to make different changes. An application for writ of errors to SCOTUS justice assigned to the Fifth Circuit. That's Joseph R. Lemire. He denied it on the 23rd. That same day on the 23rd, they then apply for a same writ of error to a different justice, Oliver Wendell Holmes, kind of a famous justice. He denies it on the 25th. Then they do an application for habeas corpus. Think about live body. That's kind of the whole idea. That's what Michael Knowles is all giddy about, that the suspension of habeas corpus during the Civil War by Lincoln. He's excited about that. But it's basically your due process rights, your ability to be. And by the way, this is an interesting filing because it's against the person that held you. So it's against this guy, Magnum. So it's Frank v. Magnum is the case that goes to the Supreme Court. Magnum was the sheriff at the time of the jail. You file it against him that he held you, detained you wrongfully. They didn't have the reason to do so. And it's filed in the district court and denied by W.M. T. Newman of the South Supreme Court of Georgia. They then appeal that to SCOTUS. It's argued on February 25th and 2015 and 26th of 2015. It's denied in April of 2015 by SCOTUS. There's two dissenters. The issues there are mob domination, jurisdiction, habeas corpus, and therefore loss of jurisdiction due to lack of due process. What are the importance of these rulings? And we'll go over those in more detail, but they're denied because you can't overturn a conviction because the jury got it wrong. That's kind of the whole idea. The jury gets to decide what the jury gets to decide. You've got to point out errors in rulings. I make an objection. Hey, that evidence is inadmissible for whatever reason. Maybe it's hearsay. Maybe it's relevancy. What is it? The big one we're going to talk about is character evidence. That comes into this the thing. And then there's some issues of waiver stuff at the end. But that's the thing. You can't overturn a conviction because the jury got it wrong. There's a writ of errors of the habeas corpus, due process regarding mob domination and not being in the courtroom when the verdict was read. That's a big deal. That's kind of their last ditch effort. And they say that this mob, and that's what I talked about, one of these books that came about, that there's, you read them at the time, and the mob domination that becomes pervasive, and it's the overwhelming issue after the time, and partly because, and what we'll let me get here in a little bit, but he gets this denied by the SCOTUS. Then the governor comes in. The governor then gives a commutation from his death sentence to life in prison. Then Leo Frank is stabbed in the neck while he's in prison. He recovers miraculously. Then he's being transferred to a different jail. He had already been transferred, and then he gets stabbed, and then the mob comes in. They grab him out of the jail. They literally do a break in to the jail. This is an A-team style thing. They take him out. They take him to Milledgeville, which was used to be where the capital of Georgia was. And that's where Mary Fagan lived. And they hung him. They lynched him at the time. Those guys never were prosecuted. It was all on the up and up as far as that goes. And then that governor obviously was, you know, kind of resigned in, or he was done. And there was, his life was never, he wasn't this hero that he thought he was going to be. So the point is, he was lynched. And so there's a feeling of this mob issue with this trial. So with the filings, and as you can see, that's what happened. And it was all this building up. So the lot of the revisionist history of this is trying to take on the fact that they believe that there was a mob that ruled this whole thing over. And we'll get into a little bit here as well, which is, Leo Frank was not present during the reading of the verdict. Okay. There's a whole issue that you should be able to, and that's what his claim of habeas corpus was, that he should have been able to, if for due process, you are into the whole entire, point of the case from start to finish, you are able to be present. Now, the problem the courts deny this on is, that's fine, but you waived this early on, and we'll get to the technical parts of that. So denial was proper because it was never brought up at the motion. We talked about, well, we'll talk about that. So you got to think of your due process. Is the fact that you're not in the courtroom at the time of the reading of the verdict, does that mean that your due process rights weren't taken care of the whole time? We will go through that. Anyway, so there's some significant parts about the judgments and why denying later on, not mentioned, but Leo Frank could have requested a change of venue for the trial. He never did. He was denied. If denied by Judge Roan, he would have had a better argument regarding all his mob stuff. So he just had it there right in Atlanta. Why not change venue so it's not such a big deal? Like I said, Governor Slayton did commute his sentence and then joined the Luther Rossler firm. What we get out of this is we get the ADL. And we also get the KKK. The KKK had been more prominent, you know, prior at the Civil War. Then it had kind of died down. I think 1870, it's kind of like lost its luster. But then you do have the movie, The Making of a Nation or Birth of a Nation that, you know, Wilson has in the White House. Mary Fagan, there were this group called the Knights of Mary Fagan, and who were all up in arms about the Jewish rise here and Leo Frank, you know, murdering, and they weren't sure if he tried to molest his child or not. And they were on her. And then when this whole, and they lynched him and that's done, that's a resurgence of the KKK. The KKK population, I think in Georgia, grew to like 150,000 somewhere in that year. And by a few years later, though, it was down to like 1,400. So once again, who won in that case? ADL or the KKK? I would surmise to say that the KKK is still coming out in that one. Okay, that's our overview of Leo Frank case. I haven't got into the details. That's just our overview of, we're setting the scene for what Leo Frank is, what the situation is, who these people are, the main characters, and then we'll go into it. Okay. One thing I thought you should maybe know about this is there's concern about, well, there's debate about, did he really commit it? There's only two people that could have done this, Leo Frank or Jim Conley. And we will get into all these details because they're fascinating about how it came out. We know, and the reason why we only know it's those two, I'll give you a little tip here, is because Leo Frank himself, at one point, he admits to helping. I'm going to play this song, Kiss Me. Is that appropriate for this kind of thing? He admits to trying to dispose of the body. Okay, so, but he says, Leo Frank told me he killed the girl and I had to help him. But that's not the worst part of it. Leo Frank first tries to pin it on a different person and then tries to pin it on Conley. And then, as we've talked about here, this guy thinks he's a white guy. The blacks are all below him and they're dirty, dirty, dirty people. And you should just, you know, he should go the way of the dodo or whatever. You should blame him and you should convict him for it, not me, because I'm Leo Frank. And that's the attitude that's just pervasive with this. Pretty disturbing. Okay, everybody, we will come back for part two. Part two, what do we got planned for part two? Well, I think we're going to break into the characters. We're going to go over the timeline of the situation, what happened. We're going to bring up some of these people, and then we'll start working our way into the murder trial itself, and then the appeals. And then we have one last thing. There has been an exoneration. Is there a pardon? Yes. But that's to come. Thanks.
Okay, I'm leaving now. Bye, guys.
But she's back.
And now.
Chick-fil-A is completely overrated. It's not that good. I prefer Zaxby's. I prefer Popeyes.
Takes a tough man to make a tender forecast, Nick. I guess that's me. Keep fucking that chicken.
Should I vote for Dick Cheney on the Libertarian Party? Do I have an obligation to vote for Dick Cheney?
I would say so.
Yes.
Did it work for those people?
No, it never does. I mean, these people somehow delude themselves into thinking it might, but it might work for us.
That one dude was like, not a podcast, I can't find it anywhere, and they don't have video.
Oh, yeah, Peter Janky, yeah.
Yeah, I blocked him.
I'll do it. If he unblocks me, I'll...
He'll buy your shirt if you unblock him, Bert.
He's a wigger.
Yeah, nothing cooler than a 49-year-old wigger. Like, yeah,
I just started live streaming. Cut me some slack. I'm pretty high-tech for a boomer. Anyways,
boomer.